Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip.
I'm your chic oasis charmer. I'm your knight in shining armor. I'm your dozen roses farmer. I'm your guy. I'm a supper club fanatic. Thunderstorm, electrostatic. From 3 points, I'm automatic. I'm your guy.
The original supper club era left a permanent mark on society. Generations from the golden age of supper clubs relished the opportunity to relive that experience. Even generations thereafter starve for a taste themselves. Fortunately for supper club enthusiasts, restaurateurs are still making efforts to keep the phenomenon alive. And nowhere in the world is the supper club experience quite like what you'll find in Wisconsin. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shireen Seward. Many of the most iconic supper clubs began in the 30s and included large dance floors, live music, and banquet halls. They were places to celebrate socializing in public, post-prohibition, when alcohol was legal once again. They were also places to show off your best date night dress and suit, fork out a little more money than usual for a high-end meal, and over the course of a couple of hours, take down a stream of whiskey sours and brandy old fashions. Historically, going to the supper club wasn't really about dinner. It was a social event. And in many ways, it still is. Though supper clubs are fewer in number than they were in their heyday, the experience is every bit as satisfying as it ever was. And for some, a night at the supper club is the perfect Friday night experience to cap off a long week or kick off a relaxing weekend. We have three guests joining us today to discuss the magic and culture of Wisconsin's iconic supper clubs. From the Wisconsin Historical Society, we welcome Jim Drager to the program. Jim, thank you for being here today.
Great to be here.
Also here is Amy Wimmer. She is the third generation owner of one of the most recognizable supper clubs in the Wisconsin Dells area, the Del Bar Supper Club. Amy, welcome to Route 51.
Thank you. I'm thrilled and honored to be on your show.
And we welcome Holly DeRuyter, producer of PBS Wisconsin's Old Fashioned, the story of the Wisconsin Supper Club. Holly, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, so happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Listeners with questions for our guests are welcome to join the conversation by calling us at 800-780-9742. You can email us too. The address is route51@wpr.org. Well, a friend of mine moved here not long ago from Georgia, and she was mystified when we invited her to a supper club. And I found it almost impossible to define to her exactly what it is. And it's probably the hardest question to answer. Holly, what makes a supper club a supper club?
That is such a good question. And that is the question I found myself, what I asked myself when I started working on my project about supper clubs. Me and another friend were living in Chicago at the time. She was also from Chicago, or also from Wisconsin. And we were trying to figure that out. Like, what makes a supper club a supper club? And a big thing we talked about is how when we walked into a supper club, you could just feel it. You felt welcomed. It felt like you were walking into someone's home, which sounds very strange, but that's the feeling, you know, it's a place to gather. The other thing that, as I did more thinking and research, is you have to have, you know, a dining area and a bar area. And sometimes those can be completely separate spaces, or sometimes they can kind of commingle. I'm thinking of Shady Sue's up in Rhinelander. You got the bar right there, and it's a really tight spaces, but then you got the dining tables around it. So it's really a place where people feel welcome. You see the owner when you walk in the door. They might know you by name if you're a regular, and you're going to have a good meal, homemade, a lot of local ingredients, and it's going to be a night of socializing, even if you're not there with your own friends. So that's a really quick summary of what I look for in a good supper club.
That's a great description. Jim, you're a historian. I understand you were with the State Historic Preservation. You were the State Historic Preservation Officer with the Wisconsin Historical Society. What did your job entail exactly?
Well, I ran an office of people who helped to preserve historic buildings and archaeological sites across the state, administer federal and state programs, the National Register of Historic Places, which a lot of people have heard of. And it was just a great job because it brought me out all across Wisconsin. I traveled to Wisconsin extensively for 31 years. So there's really nowhere in Wisconsin I have not been.
And I'll bet you've been to plenty of supper clubs along the way. So what can you tell us, Jim, about the history of supper clubs? How did they get started and what did Prohibition have to do with it?
Yeah, okay. Well, supper club, you know, my definition of supper club is it's a specific kind of dining experience. And that dining experience grows out of changes that happen as a result of Prohibition. For one thing, Prohibition put taverns out of business. All of these taverns were sitting vacant, thousands of them around the state. And as a result of that, as people are trying to figure out how to repurpose these buildings in a period of time that has what people would say no alcohol, a restaurant was kind of an obvious conversion. So the number of restaurants in Wisconsin increases by about 40% in the early years of Prohibition. And as a result of that, people began to dine out more, especially people who were working class or middle class people who hadn't really dined out very much previous to that. And the supper clubs are kind of an extension of that movement.
So, Amy, you are the third generation owner of the Del Bar in Wisconsin Dells. Your parents had it before you, your grandparents before that. When did you take over and what motivated you to do that?
I actually took over in 2018, and I was living in Colorado. I obviously grew up in Wisconsin Dells and grew up in the restaurant with my grandparents who ran it from about 1943. They opened it until the late 70s. So I've just got vivid memories of being here with my grandparents and my dad and his wife and running the restaurant. And I moved away, got into a different career in Colorado. My dad and Jane called and said, hey, we're going to sell the restaurant. And I thought, well, we can't let that happen. You know, just the thought of it going to a different family and, you know, all of the history in the Del Bar, I couldn't envision it happening. So at that point, we put the deal together and purchased the restaurant and moved back to Wisconsin. And since then, my sisters joined me, Anne, and so now we're running it together.
And Holly, you produced a program for PBS Wisconsin on Supper Club. So tell us a little bit about that project. How did you get the idea for it? And how did you go about choosing which supper clubs to highlight? There's so many.
Oh, there are so many. It was so hard to decide which ones to feature in the program. But the idea came when I grew up in Northeast Wisconsin, Oneida, which is right outside of Green Bay. And I went to school in Chicago, and I didn't think much was going to change because the whole time growing up in the Midwest, everyone tells you the Midwest has nothing culturally. We have nothing to offer. And you believe it. You believe it. Very wrong. And I thought, you know, Chicago, it's not that far from Wisconsin. It's a big city, yes, but, you know, it's not going to change that much. And Friday night would come and go. No one talked about fish fries. When I became old enough to drink, there was no brandy in the bar whatsoever.
Ouch.
Big ouch. And then Chicago's known for its extensive dining scene, and there was no supper clubs anywhere. And this is, you know, for someone who grew up thinking supper clubs were a common type of restaurant that were, you know, everywhere, like you experience in Wisconsin, it was shocking to me that I didn't see them there. So I would often take a bus up to Madison to visit my friends who were at school there. And I would tell them about this land where there was no fish fries or brandy, no supper clubs. And as a filmmaker, when I look at supper clubs, they're a great topic to cover. They're so visual, amazing architecture, amazing neon signs. I love old neon signs, and the interiors all unique and different to that owner's, you know, decorating style or maybe a theme based on its location. So as a filmmaker, I saw the supper club as a way to explore this history that I wanted to know why the brandy, why the fish fries, why supper clubs. And it was something that I wanted to do in college. Unfortunately, I didn't have a car. Shortly after college, I started dating a gentleman, and he had a car, and I lost my job during the Great Recession, and it was just the great time to hit the road with this gentleman's car. He was letting me borrow and start working on the Supper Club story. I ended up marrying the guy, so kind of worked out in the long run.
Look like it worked out in the long run. That's great.
But that experience of leaving Wisconsin is really what made me appreciate the amazing state that it is and the amazing culture that we have here and the amazing history.
I'm glad you brought up brandy. And Jim, I want to ask you about this. Wisconsin really has a proclivity for brandy, and the brandy old fashioned is a staple at supper clubs. In fact, some people rate a supper club based on how, you know, how good is the old fashioned. Why is it so popular in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, the brandy old fashioned is the consequence of really of geography and kind of historical circumstance. The Korbel brothers started brewing or started making brandy in California because there was a brandy's made from grapes, and there was a parasite that was attacking grapevines in France that almost collapsed the wine industry. So they thought it was a perfect time to enter. But when they started making brandy, they were having a very difficult time selling it. The sales just weren't there. So they decided to take a chance, and they bought a booth at the 1893 World's Fair, which happened to be in Chicago, and started selling their brandy there, allowing people to sample brandy. And a lot of Wisconsin people, because of being so close to Chicago, went to the fair, fell in love with brandy, and brandy just came back up to the state. And then brandy became the substitute alcohol for whiskey in Wisconsin old fashions. The drink itself, the old fashioned, is quite an old cocktail. It goes back as far as we can really record that. The oldest cocktail recipe book published was published in 1847, and it already had a copy or a recipe for the old fashioned, although, you know, they obviously didn't call it the old fashioned then. I like to joke, they just called it the fashioned.
Okay. But, you know, it wasn't old yet.
But it became a staple of supper clubs.
Well, Amy, what are some of the other popular supper club drinks that you serve at Del Bar? I mean, obviously the old fashioned is a big one, but what else is really popular that is just so quintessential supper club?
Well, definitely the Manhattans. We sell a lot of Manhattans, a lot of martinis. You know, people like to have their one martini before dinner. Some people have a couple. I don't advise that, but... anyway, yeah, that definitely. And then there's the ice cream drinks. Very, very popular. The Brandy Alexander, Grasshopper, Pink Squirrel, Golden Cadillacs. I mean, it's incredible how many after dinner drinks we serve. I mean, after dinner drinks are another thing that is very, I feel like it's a Wisconsin thing almost. You know, because I feel like, you know, when I was in Colorado, there wasn't a lot, oh, we're going to have an after dinner drink. But here it's definitely going to have an after dinner drink, go to the bar after dinner. But I think that is definitely a supper club thing as well.
And I have to say, when I was a kid, I loved sipping on a kitty cocktail. I was at the bar, yeah, sitting next to my dad. You know, yeah. If you go to other states, and people might find that children sitting at a bar is like, what? What is happening here? But it happens all the time here. Amy, I mean, as a supper club owner, why is that part of the experience? The kids right at the bar?
Honestly, I as far as I'm concerned, I think it's just what you do as a family going to a supper club. I mean, it's not uncommon for a family to walk in and we'll be on a wait and they've got younger kids and they just say, you know, we're going to check out the bar and see if we can eat up there because you can eat in our bar as well. But they sit at the bar and have their kitty cocktails and have dinner. And it's just part of the tradition, I believe.
It certainly is. You're listening to Amy Wimmer, Holly DeRuyter, and Jim Dreger, our guests today on Route 51, as we look at the enduring legacy of Wisconsin supper clubs. Your questions and comments are welcome, and we'd like to hear your favorite supper club story, too. Join us by calling 800-780-9742 or email us at route51@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
All of me, why not take all of me? Can't you see I'm no good without you? Take my leave.
Stepping out with my baby. Can't be wrong to feel so right. It's for sure, not for maybe, that I'm all dressed up tonight. Stepping out with my honey. Can't be bad to feel so good. Never felt quite so sunny that I keep on knocking wood.
We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Amy Wimmer, Jim Dreger, and Holly DeRuyter are our guests today for a look at Wisconsin supper clubs and what makes them so unique to our area. We'd like to hear your thoughts, your recommendations, and your memories, too. Email us at route51@wpr.org, or you can join us by phone. The number to call, 800-780-9742. So, Amy, you've been in the supper club business for a long time with your family. I know you took a break and had a career in between, but growing up in it and now running one, how are things different now compared to when earlier generations owned the Del Bar? Or have you kept much the same?
Well, I mean, we do have an extensive, as far as the food is concerned, we've got some of our signature dishes that have been on the menu since my grandparents ran it in the, you know, late 40s, 50s, 60s, things like the shrimp Dijon and chicken cordon bleu, the baked French onion soup, just to name a few. But then we've evolved over the years, and we have fresh oysters on our menu. There's new dishes that we add every year. We try to continue to add things, but it's very, very difficult because we don't want to take things away. What happens is the customers that have been coming here for generations, they come in and they're, wait a minute, what happened to this dish or what happened to that dish? So, I mean, we still have an extensive menu, but as far as the food is concerned, we've got a lot of our signature dishes that we've had for years.
For me, I got to have that relish dish. So, Jim, where did the relish dish come from? And why do some supper clubs have liver pate as part of that? So I know a lot have cheese spreads too, but the liver pate is
yeah. The relish dish is really a testimony to Wisconsin being an agricultural state. The supper club really in general is, so are the ice cream drinks. But the kind of concept that most people understand as being supper club cuisine comes from a restaurant that was started in Beverly Hills, California, by a Milwaukee guy named Frank Lawrence. And he developed kind of the quintessential cuisine, the salad bar, the Lazy Susan, the kind of standard fish fry Fridays, prime rib Saturdays and chicken Sundays, the doggy bag he invented. So a lot of those things come in from his influence. People probably know him today mostly because of his seasoning salt, which he's at a restaurant called Lori's Seasoning Salt. So if you use that, that's how you've done that.
I had no idea, but I do know that not every supper club has a relish dish. Some have just, you know, gotten rid of them. But I also know that some restaurants have, you know, like they'll never have it seems to be a regional thing. Holly, tell me about that. Like, what would I find at a supper club in like eastern Wisconsin, for example?
That's a really good question. You know, growing up in Northeast Wisconsin, salad bars were really prevalent up in that area of the state. Not that they didn't exist in other parts of the state, but, you know, relish trays weren't really something I experienced until I you know, I know down in the Madison area, I often encountered a lot of relish trays down there. Mm-hmm. And also in Beloit, I visited a couple of supper clubs down there, one being the Butterfly Club. And they had cinnamon rolls with no icing on them in their bread baskets. Mm-hmm. And then we went to other supper clubs in the area, and everybody else had cinnamon rolls in their bread baskets. So, you know, we were talking earlier about the definition of a supper club. And a big part of that is the owners put their own spin mm-hmm. on the supper club, you know, cinnamon rolls. I don't know why. Nobody could tell me why mm-hmm. they were in there, mm-hmm. but they were there. So, that's just one of the fun things when you visit different supper clubs is looking for those unique touches.
I'd add frog legs as one of the really interesting regional spins on supper clubs. You find those on along the lakeshore in northeastern Wisconsin.
Yes, and that's something that, you know, it would be really odd to somebody mm-hmm. who was, you know, say in western Wisconsin and nowhere near a place like that. You know, Amy, I've got to say, well, what does the Del Bar have? Do you have a relish tray or a salad bar or neither one?
You know, we don't have either one, but we do have our cheese spread. We've got our horseradish mm-hmm. cheddar, mm-hmm. and then we've got our white herb cheese spread. Usually it's out at the bar. We've since changed that, but you can ask for it and get it on request. But cheese and crackers to start. I've thought about doing the relish trays, so that may be coming back. This is something fun, but that's what we do.
I was just having a conversation with the manager of the Palm Supper Club, and they don't do a relish tray either. And she said, I don't know if that makes me not a supper club anymore or what. I think you're fine there. I think you're fine there. So historically speaking, the social center was always part of supper clubs. And, you know, people mm-hmm. eat out because they are social creatures. They want to be around other people. Mm-hmm. But before the 1920s, before supper clubs were really a thing, people who ate out were the wealthier people. Mm-hmm. They were people who had more money. Jim, mm-hmm. when did that begin to change?
It really started to change after Prohibition. You're absolutely right. It was a plaything of the wealthy. But, you know, a number of different forces happened in the 1920s, including Prohibition. One of the others is the rise of the automobile. Once people can own cars, they're much more mobile and they're able to take a drive out into the country to go to a supper club. And just the increase in disposable income. People are making more money. They have more money to spend. So they have, you know, beyond their what they need to support themselves, they have money to spend in the supper club.
Holly, you've toured dozens of supper clubs as part of your research, right? Tough work, right? Touring dozens of supper clubs. But so I'm going to ask you a kind of an odd question. Let's say you, Holly, you've decided to open a supper club. You've chosen a location. You got the building. You've got the business plan all put together. What must go on the menu? What has to be there?
Oh, wow. I mean, if I was making a supper club menu for the modern day supper club goer, it would of course have to focus on surf and turf. So, you know, some nice steak options and some nice seafood options. But I also feel like you need to, you know, and a lot of supper clubs are doing this too. They're expanding their menu to include vegetarian and vegan options just because, you know, people are more aware, more health conscious. You see a lot of supper clubs that'll have like the lighter side options. Mm-hmm. So for as far as main courses go, you would want to focus on those items. And of course, you know, there's always, I would either have a relish tray or salad bar. I really think people really seek that out. I think you're still a supper club if you don't have it. Cheese spreads are very popular. I think it's really great. Like Amy was saying, you know, the Del Bar has some of their own cheese spreads that they make. And that really, that's the thing that people are looking for. So you want to make sure you have some stuff on your menu that gives you that unique touch. That people will be like, we got to go to the Del Bar. I love their cheese spreads. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that's, you know, and of course the cocktails that we talked about earlier, I think those are just as important as the food. It helps with, you know, creating a social environment, because when you're at a supper club, you're there to socialize with everyone at the bar, everyone at the supper club. It's not, if you're looking to have an intimate, quiet dinner with someone, you're not going to interact with anyone else. I don't know if a supper club's the best place for it, because everyone's going to be looking to connect with you.
I've got to say, to me, there is nothing like the flavor of a juicy steak served at a supper club. It is so unique. The taste is just, you can't compare it to anything else. And I know at the Palms, I mentioned the Palms here in Wausau, they have an indoor charcoal grill. So, you know, those steaks are, they get that charcoal flavor. Amy, is a charcoal grill typical for a supper club? Or what's the secret to making those steaks taste just so good?
Well, I mean, our secret is, you know, high temperature charbroiler, and all of our steaks are prime grade. And I think that's really what sets us apart from the other supper clubs in Wisconsin. We really pride in serving only prime beef, which makes it a little bit more expensive. But I think that's what makes our steaks really unbelievable.
Well, one thing about the supper club experience, I can never eat it all. So, Jim, how did the doggy bag come about?
Well, the doggy bag was invented by Frank Lawrence in his supper club in Beverly Hills, and I think it's really telling that it was named the doggy bag because it saved people from the embarrassment of taking food that they're taking home to eat later. Oh, this spit steak, this is for the dog. We love our dog so much that we feed it prime rib, right? Most of those meals never made it to the dog, I'm just going to say.
I would imagine.
And it's also part of, you know, part of the culture of supper clubs is large portions. So they serve you intentionally more food than you can eat in a sitting, and then you take that food home with you.
You know, Holly, people are so loyal to their favorite supper clubs, and that loyalty sometimes can be passed down by generations. You know, I go to the supper clubs that my parents loved, for example. What inspires that?
You know, when I think about my childhood in Wisconsin, the supper club was definitely a big part of that. And I think those early memories of childhood and the connection to the supper club, because it, like we talked about before, it was a place where kids were welcome, even in the bar area. I grew up going to the Colonial House in Freedom, Wisconsin, and they have a really amazing bar area with cocktail tables and booths and even a room that I think had like arcade games in it. So as a child, you know, like the adults are socializing, they're drinking their old fashions, and you're exploring and you're with family, and it just brings a feeling of, you know, togetherness and good times. So the supper club, love for the supper club is ingrained in us early on. So I don't know. Did I answer your question? I'm trying to remember.
Yes. Exactly. Yes, you absolutely did. Thank you. I know that for a time, supper clubs were in decline. Many closed. Amy, how did your family work to keep the Del Bar open and relevant when people were gravitating for a while toward chain restaurants?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have got, you know, something special in the fact that just to play on your, you know, what makes it people coming back and generational is that people have so many memories as kids growing up. I mean, it's not uncommon every night for somebody to come up and say, hey, you know, I've been coming here since for 60 years. And I just think we have such a great following. What did we do to stay relevant? I think just continuing to provide a very high quality, you know, food items and service. A lot of our staff has been here for some 30 years. So I think that makes, you know, keeps us relevant and keeps people coming back. I mean, a lot of people come, they request a certain server. They want to sit at the bar and talk to the bar staff that's been here for 10 plus years. I mean, it's part of their kind of lifestyle. They, you know, they come here to meet friends. They come, you know, I also I might be getting a little off track here, but I think it's important to, I've seen in the 3 years that I've been back, I've seen people start forming friendships at the bar. And then all of a sudden they're coming in with these people that I introduced them at the bar. Hey, you should meet these guys. Or they started talking and now they're having dinner together every Friday. So I think just our history and being here for so long helps keep relevant through the times when supper clubs maybe went away for a little bit. But I also think in the last 10 years, supper clubs have definitely made a major comeback. even to the point where there's supper clubs opening in Chicago in different cities, you know, and it's a really kind of a hot thing. So,
and Jim, what are your thoughts about that? What do you think brought about this kind of resurgence in the popularity of supper clubs in recent years?
I think part of it's just pure and simple nostalgia. Supper clubs are nostalgic in Wisconsin because they're so commonplace and they're so much a part of everybody's experience. So people go to them, you know, like Amy said, because they have been going to them and their families have been going to them for generations now.
You are listening to Jim Drager, Holly DeRuyter, and Amy Wimmer. They are our guests today on Route 51 as we look at what makes Wisconsin supper clubs so popular and so unique. What's your favorite supper club? We'd like to hear from you. Join us by calling 800-780-9742. You can also email route51@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Cha-cha-cha, d'amour, take to my lover, shoo-shoo, little bird, go and find my love. Cha-cha-cha, d'amour, serenade at her window, shoo-shoo, little bird.
Never know how much I love you. Never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a fever that's so hard to bear. You give me fever. When you kiss me, fever. When you hold me tight, fever. In the morning, a fever all through the night.
We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Amy Wimmer, Jim Drager, and Holly DeRuyter are our guests today for a look at Wisconsin supper clubs and what makes them so special in our area. We'd like to hear your thoughts, too. Your recommendations and memories are also welcome. Email us at route51@wpr.org or join us by phone by calling 800-780-9742. I'd like to talk about fish fries a little bit. When I started to travel a little bit more in my 20s, I think it was the first time I realized that fish fries are a Wisconsin thing. Growing up, you think that fish fries are everywhere, right? Yeah. But they have fish and chips in other states, but it's really not the same. So why is a fish fry so popular here? How did that get started? Jim, what are your thoughts?
Well, part of it has to do with, again, with the great, with Prohibition and the opening up of taverns as restaurants. And the thing about the perch fry is perch were cheap fish. They were working class fish. That was the fish that poorer people ate. So taverns started featuring those because you could sell them very cheaply and it would bring in a lot of customers. So the perch fry just becomes kind of the centerpiece of this new cuisine, and especially in places in Wisconsin that were heavily Catholic, it tied into the Catholic tradition of not eating meat on or red meat on Fridays, and just kind of became the staple of Friday evening supper club cuisine.
Holly, I'm really curious about the documentary you produced. It's so good. It's called Old Fashioned, the Story of the Wisconsin Supper Club. We talked about it a little bit earlier, but I'd like to know a little bit more. How long did it take to make it? And and what did you find most surprising about the whole experience?
So it took me 6 years to make that film. And it's because it was a passion project. So at the time, I was living in Chicago. And I would come up to Wisconsin as much as I could to work on the film. But then there's always that pesky thing to need to work for money. So that would always kind of take over sometimes. And I was freelancing. So whenever I would have some time off, I would always come back up to Wisconsin and try to document and feature different supper clubs. And it was important for us that we feature supper clubs from all across the state, because it was something that it's not just, you know, some people think, oh, they're only in southern Wisconsin. And we just wanted to show that this is a proud Wisconsin tradition that all Wisconsinites share in. And that was kind of a challenge because at the time, this was before Facebook had business pages. Not a lot of people, not a lot of businesses had websites yet. We forget how quickly technology has changed everything. So finding supper clubs, it was a lot of word of mouth or picking up a local phone book or tourist booklet and just looking for supper clubs to be advertised. Because we were looking for in areas that, you know, I didn't have personal connections or I wasn't familiar with. So that's kind of how the project started. And 6 years. And when we started, you know, to kind of touch on what you talked about earlier, how supper clubs went through some tough times where people were going to the chain restaurants. And when I started to talk to supper club owners in 2009, they were saying, this is it. Our clientele's dying off. We're not going to be around very much longer. And people were happy that I was documenting it because they're like, this is disappearing. And then when my film came out 6 years later, and after that, when I would see supper club owners or visit with them, and they're like completely different. We've seen a complete change. The young people are coming in. They're bringing their kids. We're not shutting down. The next generation is taking over. And that just made me so happy. And a lot of that was, you know, people just wanting that unique experience and sick of the chain restaurants and the sterile, uninvitive environment that it provides.
So, Jim, you're an expert on architecture. That's one of your main areas of focus. So what are some commonalities you'll find at supper clubs from an architectural standpoint? They all have a bar, and many mm-hmm. of them are pretty dark and windowless. Mm-hmm. So what's mm-hmm. unique about them?
Well, I think it goes back to the purpose of the cuisine in supper clubs, and they're meant to be slow dining experiences. You go to a supper club and you have your drinks, your before dinner drinks, you eat your meal, you have your after dinner drinks. And it's really something that you spend an entire evening doing. So the supper clubs are kind of set up architecturally to accommodate that. One of the kind of universal traits of supper clubs is that you order at the bar and then eat at the table later. And they do that because the tables turn over fairly slowly. So they've got to queue up the next people as those tables become available. So architecturally, you're going to see supper clubs with a bar that's sometimes separate, sometimes integrated into the dining room. You eat at tables. The tables have white, they have linen cloths because it's meant to be an upscale dining experience as well. They tend to be dark because the darkness of them is part of the atmosphere. It's creating that kind of sitting around the hearth kind of experience with them. And then in terms of how they're decorated or styled, as Holly referred earlier, a lot of them are themed based on locations. So you've got the North Woods, and you get see a lot of North Woods themed ones with log buildings and mounts on the walls and that kind of thing. And as you get to more urban spaces, they tend to be more urban. The Del Bar is a great example of a really kind of high-end supper club decor. So I think they're characterized by kind of a very familial feeling to them.
Sure, that makes sense. I think we all have supper club memories that date back to our youth, right? Holly, what's your first supper club memory? Do you have one?
I think my first supper club memory is actually from at Colonial House and hiding and running around their cocktail lounge and, of course, getting a kitty cocktail. You know, that was always a special treat we were excited for. And, you know, the one thing that always sticks with me, and I kind of blame this on my personal taste and my home decor, is there was always really rich decorations, like really interesting carpet patterns, a lot of velvet, leather, just really interesting. You know, they don't redecorate often supper clubs. And I think that's something that people, you know, it's kind of like the menu. They don't like it when you rechange the decorations mm-hmm. either. Mm-hmm. You know, they come mm-hmm. in expecting to see certain things. And mm-hmm. I grew up going to Tomahawk. I consider that to be my second home. So I have a lot of early memories of old resort supper clubs and up there. And, you know, up there, the decor is always taxidermy. So lots of memories of seeing a variety of taxidermy. And that always holds a very special place in my heart.
And Amy, growing up in the supper club business, I'm sure your experience is really different from ours. I mean, you grew up basically with the supper club being so much a part of your life. I'm curious what it's like for you to visit other supper clubs or restaurants. I mean, in your past career, you traveled quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Did you get ideas from other restaurants you visited, or are you constantly comparing the food and the service to what you've got at home?
Constantly comparing, definitely. It is. It is every meal is an R&D experience, right? It's really fun getting out and going to other restaurants. And we did as kids. We went to a lot of supper clubs and different restaurants. And my mom loved to take us to nice dinners. And we'd go up to Green Lake and go to Norton's or the old Gobbler in between here and Milwaukee with the rotating bar, and love that place. So I have so many memories of different restaurants. But as an adult and, you know, traveling all over with my other career, it was just so much fun to go into restaurants and get ideas. And, you know, once I knew I was coming back and doing this, it really became even more fun to go out for dinner and to different restaurants. I was in Boulder, Colorado, and look at what they did and what ideas I could bring back to this restaurant, to the Del Bar. And so it's just a lot of fun getting out and having dinner at other restaurants.
The farm-to-table movement is really grown in popularity once again. And Jim, people are looking for an experience now that's different from that fast food and chain restaurant experience. How important is the farm-to-table movement to today's supper clubs?
Well, I would say not just today. I think it's a defining part of what supper clubs are. They have always been used local vendors for food, and the cuisine reflects the local tastes of the area. So I think it's just a quintessential part of it. And that's part of the popularity of the resurgence of supper clubs, is people understand that they're in place, that supper clubs are places like the other kinds of restaurants that they go to that are farm to table.
Amy, what about your business at the Del Bar? Do you work with a lot of local producers? How do you go about choosing who to work with for meats and other supplies?
Yeah, we definitely stay local. As far as our meats, our beef has always come from a great company out of Madison, Nesvig's, and that's over 40 years, that relationship. And then as far as produce, we have got unbelievable growers right here in the Wisconsin Dells area. Organic Valley Mushroom Farm is just about 10 miles down the road. We've got a couple different Country Bumpkin and Fox Farms for tomatoes and lettuce. We are getting so much right now as far as produce from these local farmers, and it's outstanding. You can't find better. It's hard to find better than the farmers around here. So,
Holly, what can you tell me about some notable clubs in our area in central and northern Wisconsin? There are some great supper clubs. Which are the ones that really stand out to you besides the Del Bar, of course?
You know, yeah, the Del Bar, of course. You know, a lot of times I find myself up in northern Wisconsin in the fall and winter time, and the White Stag always stays open through the winter. I think they only close for major holidays, so the White Stag is one that I am always seeking out. Also, Club 32 is one I discovered one time when I was leaving the Dells, driving back to Madison. We had just done an event on supper clubs, and we didn't even know that one existed. So that's one of the fun things about supper clubs, is when you take those back roads and those areas you've never been before, you're always bound to discover something. Jim and I, we've been to the Hobnob in the Racine Kenosha area. And that one's amazing. You know, you're on Lake Michigan, you got a great view of the lake, and it's got, you know, that's a place that it has not changed its decor since it was built, I don't think. You know, beautiful white leather booths, you know, just a really amazing retro decor in that supper club. Other ones that I enjoy up in the Tomahawk area when I'm up there is, you know, supper clubs are kind of funny. They can be out in the country or they can be in the city. In the city, there's the Pine Tree that's right on Main Street in Tomahawk. But if we want a beautiful view of a lake, we can go to Bootleggers. That's one that's really got an amazing view, amazing deck you can go sit out on. So let me think if there's anything else. Oh, and a lot of supper clubs, I think people forget they were tied to resorts. You know, a lot of these old resorts up north had supper clubs in them. And one that is still around and I love, they're a great example of, you know, classic supper club menu, but they have modernized it, is Three Coins Restaurant at Holiday Acres. You have to go down some windy roads to get there, but it's definitely worth the trip. And, you know, all these places have different environments, so it's always what you're in the mood for. You know, do you want to go sit by a lake, or do you want to be more in a cozy log cabin environment?
Jim, what's your favorite part of the Wisconsin Supper Club experience? What really makes it for you?
You know, I'm a history junkie. So the thing that I really love about supper clubs is how telling they are of Wisconsin culture. The stories of everything related to them are Wisconsin stories. And they connect very deeply into the foodways and ethnic predilections and the kind of lifestyles of people who live in Wisconsin. They're quintessentially Wisconsin.
They certainly are. Amy, I've got to ask, what do you think the future looks like for supper clubs? What kind of challenges do you think that you'll be facing moving forward? COVID had to present some significant hurdles for your business, as it did for many restaurants, but what do you think moving forward? Does the future look bright for supper clubs?
I think it does. I think that I really do. I think that there's this whole new generation. I mean, I think the millennials are definitely coming out and enjoying supper clubs. I mean, obviously challenges right now are food costs is pretty tough, but I don't think that that's long-term. But I do think that, you know, so we continue to talk about supper clubs and write about them, make movies about them and things like that. I really think that this newer generation they enjoy going to supper clubs.
They do
happy hours, things like that.
Happy hours,
and throwing that in there. That was one thing I wanted to talk about earlier. That's really helped our business, and knowing that you don't have to come in here and have a big dinner, and you can come in here and grab some small plates and salads and something a little bit lighter. And I think that new generation loves that happy hour too.
They sure do.
Yeah.
Jim, what are your thoughts on the future of supper clubs? Are they here to stay?
Well, you know, as a historian, I'm going to say that change is always a constant. And supper clubs have evolved since the day they originated and will continue to evolve. And they're going to evolve in ways that express the beliefs, values of people who are coming to them today. So I think we can look at some of the trends that are happening. I think Holly mentioned the fact that you can now go to a supper club and find vegan items on the menu as, you know, just a response to changing cultural beliefs in general.
We have about 30 seconds left. Holly, what do you think the key is for continued survival and the thriving of supper clubs in the future?
I think that personal touch is really important. Having owners like Amy there present in the business is really important, and it's what's going to make that personal connection, that personal feel to the supper clubs.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank all three of you. You have been wonderful guests, and it has been so much fun to talk about the supper clubs that make Wisconsin so special. That is all the time we have today on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Once again, I'd like to thank our guests, Amy Wimmer, Jim Drager, and Holly DeRuyter. Our producer is Joy Ratch Kramer. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Rick is also our on-air producer today. Special music today was provided by John Peserly, Billie Holiday, Tony Bennett, Dean Martin, Peggy Lee, and Frank Sinatra. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program at WPR.org/Route51. Coming up next week, we're going to have a rollicking good time with a group of four area bluegrass musicians. And in 2 weeks, an update on the coronavirus vaccine from both a health standpoint. We're heading to town.
someday when I'm awfully low, when the world is cold, I will feel a glow just thinking of you and the way you look tonight. Yes, you're lovely with your smile so warm and your cheeks so soft.